love this podcast? Support us by leaving us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. Hit the link in the episode description to support us now. Thanks for listening and enjoy.
Is anybody there? Can anybody hear me? Who are you trying to talk to? Are you trying to talk to Rolando? Are you trying to talk to Nicole? Are you trying to talk to Eddie Z? Are you trying to talk to the filmmakers of the Blythe Spirit remake? We'll get in line, because we got a lot to say to them, too. My name is Nicole.
And I'm Rolando.
And this is Remakes, Reboots, and Revivals.
An original podcast.
About unoriginality. Here we are. You know, it's not snowing, which is great. It's a rarity for the Northeast in early 2021.
I know. Who'd have thought?
Yeah. Seriously.
After last year, I just assumed it would not be at all like a thing.
Yeah, we barely had a winter in the Northeast, and then all of February there was snow on the ground and at least two storms. So that's been fun, but we can't go anywhere anyway, so might as well be stuck inside.
Indeed, watching movies that watching we didn't movies. Know were out.
Yes. So, you know, it's funny because we've been covering television since the start of this new year.
Oh, and we needed a break.
We needed a break. Was this the break that we needed? We'll see.
This was a break.
This was a break from movies.
And I appreciate it. I was, when Nicole offered a movie, I was just like, yes, please. I can't watch.
Seriously.
I can't sit and binge 6 episodes of a TV show. And here's the thing, right? I will binge TV shows if they're good. It's just unfortunate that we've been binging shows that just have not been that good.
Yeah, we haven't gotten off to the best start, at least with the 2021 properties. I think the things we did enjoy came out last year.
Yeah.
And I'll say this. For the price that we paid for the movie, at least that I paid, you know, it was cheaper than a movie ticket. So if they had charged me more than $10, I think I would have been absolutely outraged.
I would agree. Well, spoiler alert already, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you clicked on the episode, so you must know that today we're talking about Blythe Spirit. We're talking about the 1945 film and this new 2020/2021 movie remake. It was supposed to have came out last year.
But because of coronavirus, it got set back, pushed back. I don't even think it's right now just streaming. I don't know.
I saw it was playing in a theater in North Jersey.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So it's playing in some theaters. I'm sure it's playing in more theaters in New York.
I bet you the only people in attendance are ghosts.
Oh. But you can find it. I watched it on YouTube. And I know you said you watched it on Amazon. So it's available on most streaming platforms for like $6 because...
Correct.
It would have been an outrage if they charged us more for this.
I think $6 is fine. It doesn't hurt the pocket as much as like sometimes when you're streaming early in the pandemic with those $18 jammies, which is crazy if you think about it, because that's still less than a ticket, than 2 tickets. But it's still just like the audacity. It's just like, seriously. I am home, sir. Like, why am I paying all this money?
I think that this movie should have been $2, and even then, you know, it wasn't worth it.
Right.
So anyway,
you're really getting ahead of ourselves here.
I mean, if you can't tell, it wasn't the best movie. But let me say this: I really pushed for this movie in particular, and that's more so because I really wanted I wanted Rolando and maybe some people who listen to this episode to feel encouraged to watch the original, which is a film that I actually quite like. So before we get into talking about the properties of the 1941 and the 1945 and the 2021 movies, we should talk a little bit about the background and the history, which is always my favorite part.
Yes, it is.
So
I know nothing about
you know
movie.
Nothing, which I can't wait to inform you.
Didn't even know this movie existed.
Yes. Yeah, so here's the thing. This is as British as you get. Okay. We covered very few British films before. I think the only other one we might have done was Black Narcissus.
Rebecca.
No, that was a Hollywood production.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I guess Black Narcissus.
Yeah. So like this is like by, you know, made in England, produced by an English company, you know, all English cast. I mean, this is as English as you get. So yeah, the only other one that we did is Black Narcissus. I actually really love British films. I feel like they often get overshadowed. I mean, everyone gets overshadowed by American films, period. Everyone does. But
yeah,
because they're English speaking and so many actors are in both American films and English films, sometimes people don't even know whether or not it's an American film or an English film. But then correct. Especially the classics, you know, we just they don't get half the recognition that they should. So this is very much a British and old English film, and it is based off of a play.
By, I don't think it's old English. Old English would imply it's like a medieval.
Okay, so you're taking that a little, little old British film. Let me say that. I'm going back and forth between British and English, but
okay.
So this is written by a man named Noel Coward, who was a playwright. He was a composer, a director, an actor, a singer. He was just kind of like a jack of all trades.
Was and he also a coward?
Was he? He was the coward.
Yeah, I mean, you write Noel ghost Coward. Stories, right? Yeah. So.
Well, maybe. So Noel Coward, you know, there's a, I like to describe him as like that guy who attends the party with like a cigarette in one hand, a martini in the other, and just like
that's
waiting
me.
For shit to go down.
So oh, yeah. That's
usually, who this guy is.
I'm usually the reason the shit goes down somehow, some way.
Well, there you go. I think you would enjoy Noel Coward, and we'll see how you felt about the original. He was known for his wit. He was known for his flamboyance and, you know, the characters that he portrayed, which were, you know, at the end of the day, they weren't the most generous, most caring individuals, but they were real. And they were also just so lovingly snobbish, I would describe.
All right. I mean, just from watching this one movie alone, I could tell you just like likable characters. These are not.
They are not. And that is also very Noel Coward. He's quite large in the theater scene, at least. There's a theater named after him in London. You know, he was at least huge in the West End. And, you know, he's been respected in American theater as well. He wrote this in...
I was gonna ask, was this based off of a play?
This was based off of a play. So he wrote a bunch of plays.
It has very play vibes.
It is. Yeah. So just some other plays that he wrote that you might have heard of: Private Lives, Designed for Living, Present Laughter, and Hay Fever. He also wrote musicals, but he's more known, I think, for his plays. And then, of course, Blight Spirit. Blight Spirit came out in 1941. It's been revived quite many times. I think the most recent one actually was in 2010 with Angela Lansbury.
Oh.
I
could tell who she played.
You know who she played.
Yeah.
So Blight Spirit came out in 1941. Massive success. Ran for almost 2,000 performances. Came to Hollywood. Was a big success there. And almost immediately, they were like, we want to make this a movie. And Hollywood approached him first. And Noel Coward said no. Because, you know, the times that Hollywood has done my movies, they've made it more vulgar. And I didn't care for it. You know, very, very critical man.
What Hollywood movies were made of his?
Well, actually, so Designed for Living is a play of his that was made into a 1933 film that I actually really love because it's actually about a three-person relationship.
Oh, a throuple.
Yeah, a throuple with two men and a woman. So scandalous. Yeah, Hollywood. And it's just so delightful. And it's got that Noel Coward wit. So they're coming at each other like line after line. But he actually didn't like it. And... Mm-hmm. Not surprisingly, he didn't actually care for the 1945 film version of Blight Spirit. He was also just, you know, like I said, he's that guy with a cigarette in one hand and the martini just judging you from afar. Mm-hmm. 1941 has actually a good amount of the people in the film in it. We have Margaret Rutherford is reprising her role from the stage into film as Madame Marcotti. We have Kay Hammond, who is reprising her role as Elvira. People who did not reprise their role were actually Charles Condamine, who was originally played by Cecil Parker, but in the film is played by Rex Harrison.
Oh, Cecil Parker. Oh, both names are familiar. Rex Harrison.
Rex Harrison, you would remember from Dr. Doolittle.
Oh, okay. There we go.
Yeah.
Yes.
Faye Compton did not reprise her role as Ruth, but somebody, I think she did it on the American stage. Don't quote me on that. I might be wrong, but most of these people have played these roles before. So it was very much, you know, going from the play directly into the film. Mm-hmm. The filmmaker for Blight Spirit 1945 is David Lean, who is a renowned filmmaker. If you don't know him by this, which I'm sure you don't, Rolando, you would know him from The Bridge on River Kwai, Lawrence of Arabia, Dr. Zhivago, these kinds of movies. This is what
I know Lawrence of Arabia.
Yeah, that's considered one of the best British films ever. So
And I also know the River Kwai one because of Parks and Rec. So there you go.
And River Kwai is a very good Guys on a Mission movie.
Yeah.
So he was known later on in his career for those, you know, big movies. But early on, he was actually doing a bunch of Noel Coward adaptations. Like the very same year, he made a film called Brief Encounter, which is actually a beautiful and way, like between the 1945 David Lean films, it's the far superior film.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, whatever. We're not talking about that today. Noel Coward was actually rather unhappy with the film. He was like, look, just film it and just put it on film. But David Lean made a bunch of changes, actually, that Noel Coward just simply did not care for. So what is the plot of Blythe Spirit? It's really simple, actually. Charles Condamine's a mystery writer. He needs inspiration for his latest book, and he wants to actually get, you know, a first-person account of how something like a seance works as material for his next book. So he invites a local woman over who is a medium, and she's a bit of an eccentric, to perform a seance. The seance occurs, and lo and behold, even though she didn't mean to, she actually resurrects and makes a apparition out of Charles's first dead wife, Elvira. Not Elvira, mm. Elvira.
I thought it was Elvira.
Elvira, right? Weren't they saying Elvira the whole
Maybe
time?
Maybe they were saying Elvira in this version. I think you're right. I think it was Elvira.
Yeah, I think it's Elvira. Elvira. And much to, you know, the annoyance of the husband and the second wife. That's pretty much the plot. And that will also be the plot in the later on film in the 2021, but they make a couple additions and whatnot there, and they really expand it from there. But so the film is still very much, it feels like a play.
Right.
The play kind of just takes place in the living room. It never changes locations. There are times where we change locations in the film. Mm-hmm. You know, why not? It's a fucking film. Like, at least change the location because, you know, it's not a play. It's a film. And then two, because it's on the stage, we never ever see things from the point of view of those who cannot see Elvira. We ourselves can see Elvira just like Charles does. But in the film, they do a lot of fun trickery where they show you either her there, like from Charles's point of view, or her not there from Ruth's point of view. And that was actually something that Noel Coward did not like.
Interesting. I don't know why. Like, that's literally the whole point of having film.
Yes. Well, it
like having a medium
plays funnier when you actually see her. But I think
I feel like that's debatable.
Yeah, that was his opinion. But nonetheless, I think when you're adapting for film, changes like this should be made. One of the most interesting things that I think that they opted to do was to not do double exposure whenever Elvira was on screen, and that they just did a really interesting makeup job.
Well, there was points. There was double exposure times.
Not a lot. When people walked through her and whatnot.
Yeah. And there was also times where, because he was also double exposed at times too, because you could see, I caught, like, the first time that he puts his hand through her.
Yes. So in those instances,
he's also double exposed. Yeah. He's also double exposed. And I was just like, this is bad camera work.
Wow.
I'm messing. It was good. I thought it was good. I thought the makeup job was good to make her look ghostly.
Yeah, she actually does look ghostly, and they like put a certain type of clothes on her, and they always had a light on her, so she does kind of like come off as, you know, like, mm-hmm. it's kind of fluorescent and whatnot. They make her green with red lipstick, which I found was really interesting because the second wife is wearing a green dress and is a redhead. So something's going on with those, you know, colors that the two of them are wearing.
I didn't put that together, but yeah. I mean, she does have a greenish hue.
She has a very greenish hue, almost like her body is, you know, like rotted. And, right. You know, like her dress is gray, but it's very greenish and whatnot. So She looks like a dead person, right? You can tell that she's in contrast to everyone around her.
Correct. From a visual point of view, she looks like a ghost.
Yes. And in true Noel Coward fashion, you know, nobody's really concerned too much with, like, oh my God, how the hell is a ghost here? It's mostly like, oh my God, how do we get her out of here?
It was more like, oh my God, this is annoying.
Yeah. Oh my God, this is annoying. I can't believe my dead ex-wife is back.
I mean, the second wife really had no concern about his mental well-being.
Yeah.
Because, I don't know.
All these characters are selfish. All of these characters really just care about their own, except for Madame Arcadi. They only really care for their own
fate. But she's a fraud.
So, and first of all, we don't know that. She actually conjured up Elvira, so she's not a fraud.
Is she, by accident?
Yeah, but still, she succeeded. I mean, like, it's hard to know exactly how to do such things, and yet she was able to do it. She just wasn't able to completely be in control of it. And that's hard. You're conjuring up the dead. Like, come on.
I don't know.
I'm going to defend this version of Madame Arcati till end of the earth.
She said, she's like, oh, that's never happened to me before. Great, cool.
Yeah, she did let it slip. Yeah, so. I mean, so the thing about this film, other than its snappy dialogue of Noel Coward, is it's all about the performances and the dialogue. And I think that in terms of performances, the standout here is Madame Arcati. I think this is the Madame Arcati show, in my opinion. When I watch this film, I think the only person that makes me laugh out loud, and I do personally, I actually laugh out loud when I watch this film, is Margaret Rutherford as Madame Arcati. I just think she's so wonderful in this film. I think that the other women are great. And I think that Rex Harrison is good. I think he's a little cold. You know, I think he delivers his lines fantastically. And he always does, as, you know, Henry Higgins in My Fair Lady and Dr. Dolittle and all the other films he's been in. He's great at delivering lines, but, you know, he should give a little heart here and there.
Right.
Whereas Margaret Rutherford, you know, she's just so endearing. She's like so... She's adds all the heart that there is, you know, and she's also, sometimes she's embarrassing and sometimes she's silly. And then sometimes you're just completely on her side. And I just think that her portrayal of Madame Arcati is so fantastic.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. I don't know. I didn't care for Madame Arcati.
Yeah. That's a shame. You didn't like the woman's performance at all, or
So I think I was very much like kind of on her while watching the performance. It didn't seem like it was neither too wacky, and I thought it was like a lot more subdued.
That's so interesting,
especially for a comedy, right? Like I was expecting we're going the comedy route, right? This felt, I don't know, I wanted it, maybe I was expecting a lot more slapstick humor or straight up just farce, because this is like a really silly premise. Yeah. Right, you conjure up the spirit of your ex, your dead wife, right? Correct me if I'm wrong. You don't consider, do you call a wife who has died the ex-wife? No, right? It's your first wife.
Your first wife.
It's not an ex-wife, right? Because she died. She's not, you didn't divorce.
Yeah, she's the anyway, first wife.
Okay, so you conjure up the spirit of the first wife, and now your first wife is trying to possibly seduce you, maybe kill you to bring you to the afterlife. She wanted to kill him, but
she wanted him to join her.
Is that what it was? Mm-hmm. I didn't get that much vibe as much as, I don't know. I don't know. Yeah, it seemed like a silly concept, right? So you expect a little bit of, I don't know. I expected maybe the comedy to be a little more heightened. I thought this for a comedy was a little more subdued, and Madame Arcati's performance, while maybe the wackiest out of all of them, it was still kind of just like a little vanilla, in my opinion.
It's interesting.
So I actually think my favorite performance actually came from Elvira. I thought she was the funniest.
She was. Yeah, I think she's my second favorite, but I guess the only thing I'll say too in regards of the comedy is that, other than the fact that it's a play and it's all based off of its dialogue, this is also like very British.
Mm-hmm.
There is a coldness about these characters and whatnot. It's also very Noel Coward, you know, they're selfish, cold people at the end of the day. So done right, you know, which I think this movie to an extent is done right. I don't think it's the greatest British or the funniest British film ever, but I think that they really understood their characters, and I think that they all delivered pretty well to the point where you either love them or you hate them.
I don't know if I hated anybody. I except for maybe, I guess, the main character, Mr.
Charles Condamine.
Yes. Like, he was like, the only one who you kind of just, like, are not. I guess for him to be the lead, like you said, he was cold, right? And I agree. Sometimes his delivery was, like, more so vicious than it was, like, kind of sweet.
Yeah. Well, that's how they all kind of, like, you know, these three, the two wives and the husbands, I don't think they like each other very much, and I don't think they like many people very much. Madame Arcati, to me, is a very direct contrast to all of them, because, you know, she's very, like, she's warmer than the rest, and she doesn't consider, like, they all kind of laugh at her, you know, but she takes what she does a little bit more sincerely.
I agree with you on that one. That's true.
So it's like, even though, you know, there's not a lot of, like, say, slapstick or physical comedy going on, I don't know. For me, I felt the difference between the two. And I just felt that she was more of, like, my heart actually went more out to her as a character. Because I know that everybody looked down on her and thought she was a fool and that she actually believed in what she was doing, whether or not she right. was very good at it. And I thought that she was the most fleshed out character and portrayed really well. I just love Margaret Rutherford. Margaret Rutherford mm-hmm. went on, you know, she's in this great film version of The Importance of Being Earnest. She went on to play Miss Marple, an Agatha Christie character in 4 films. So I just have I think she's a very unique and English actress that not a lot of people know about. And, you know, this is one of the best portrayals of that she's done on film, I think. I think it really shows how great of an actress she was. But
interesting. Okay.
I do want to talk about Kay Hammond as Elvira. I think her delivery, more than anything, is just, it's so, like we said, cold, right? These characters are kind of cold. And yes. like, literally, Elvira is cold. She's dead. And right. so she just comes across that really well, the way she like snaps back at first when like the Ruth doesn't know that she's there and just making uh-huh. all these comments under her breath. Everything yeah. she says to me essentially lands.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, she's a mean girl.
She is a mean girl. She's you so it's interesting because you're trying to figure out the dynamics between some of these characters. Like pretty early on you realize that like Ruth and Charles, you know, they don't have the best marriage.
I don't know. I felt like
they just kind of live with each other. There's not like a lot of love.
In terms, I don't know. It seemed like, correct me if I'm wrong, but like back then, wasn't that how all love was?
That you're wrong.
I don't. I feel like that's how marriages were back in the day. Back prior to the 1960s, all marriages were cold and loveless.
Yeah, maybe you should read like a book from before the 1960s.
Oh, books are fiction. That's not real.
All right,
I want to read.
They evoked in their books just came.
I want to read
air.
A real person's journal from back then. I bet you it would be. It's just like a ghost is haunting my husband. Finally, he can be off of me for a night. That is, I bet you more journals are written that
maybe,
way.
Maybe you know, an upper class society, right? I mean, this is something that we see portrayed in our media a lot more, and I think that might be also where you're getting the perception maybe. From. You know, a more well-off snobbish people tend to not really like be affectionate and care for each other in older films. I don't think
general.
that was the thing though. I don't.
All right.
but regardless, it seems like, you know, the marriage between Charles and Elvira was just like, it was like, there was a lot of passion at one time, but by the time she had died, it had gone. And the passion out of Ruth and Charles's relationship has pretty much also left.
Because I feel like, if anything, the feeling that I got was maybe that Charles was taking Ruth for, taking advantage of, not taking advantage of her, but like kind of like not appreciating her.
Taking
now.
Her for
Ruth,
granted, probably, yeah.
Yes, there mm-hmm. we go. Thank you. Because Ruth is kind of a hot piece. She's classy. She's sophisticated and yeah. stuff. And he was kind of taking her for granted.
Yeah, I would say I would agree with
real.
That. Yeah.
Charles was not all that rich, I guess, but okay.
Yeah, well, these
she
are
could,
all.
She could find another rich man.
These are a bunch of characters who kind of do take one another for granted. I mean, they took Madame Arcadi for granted. And then at the end, they needed her help. Even. And then they took the maid for granted, and she ended up being the source of everything.
Oh, yeah. What was that about? So
you kind of have to really pay attention to the dialogue in order to, like, 100% get it. Because when I first watched it, too, I was like, what? How did that wrap everything up? You know, that kind of didn't make sense to me.
Yeah, the maid's involvement.
Yeah, so it's pretty much that while they were conducting the seance, the character of the maid had wanted someone to come back on her own. So when Madame Arcadi was conversing with Daphne, you remember the mm-hmm. her like spirit guide Daphne?
Yeah.
You know, and Daphne went out looking for who they were calling for. She mistakenly got Elvira, because Elvira says, oh, this child with a light just came towards me and told me to come with her. You know, she's like, I didn't want to come here. Like, literally, I was dragged by this girl with a light, who is Daphne. But Daphne was looking for who the maid was looking for.
But why? Okay, but why would Daphne think that the maid was looking for Elvira?
Because I guess, you know, communication gets a little hazy when it's in between two different dimensions. That, I don't know, but Daphne got the wrong person back, yeah.
So, I mean, I kind of wish that, like, Elvira and Daphne had a salacious affair that was going to be revealed.
Now, that would have been
end
cool.
Of it.
Yeah.
Right? I think there you go. Now it's just like, well.
Yeah. Well, so
take that, Charles.
Noel Coward does not really have much time for actually researching how any of this shit works. He clearly doesn't believe in it. He's just presenting it to you in terms of a farce and in terms of, you know, three people who don't want to be stuck together who are stuck together and who are annoying the shit out of each other. So yeah, like he doesn't, he clearly has no time to worry anything about like the science of any of that. He just presents it in his own little way. Right. I don't think it's the strongest, you know, like way to tie that all up in a nice little bow.
Uh-huh. As to like why the ghost is still sticking around.
Yeah. Or why they can't get rid of her, or how it happened with like the maid, you know.
Which also, now follow up question after the maid, right? Yeah. Why after Madame Arcadi, when after Madame Arcadi thinks she got rid of the ghost, right? Does she instantly feel like some bad juju and it's just like, you need to get out of here, you need to leave? Like that confused me because it's just like, so again, this is what I'm thinking. It's just like, so Madame Arcadi is, and again, admitting that she's a fraud, a huckster.
Well, you know, she also admitted that she had the faintest idea as to how to get rid of a spirit. She only knew how to conjure it up, and then only one time before did it work, I think.
Which I do appreciate, though, for comedy, because, like, I think, isn't that the goal of, like, a lot of these characters? Like, you conjure up the spirits, but it's like, all right, but how do you get rid of it?
Yeah.
Like, mm-hmm. After I have my conversation with the dead one, how do I release it?
Well, I will say that in the play, he doesn't die, right? Spoiler alert, if you're listening to this and you haven't seen it and you actually want to, at the end, Charles dies in the movie. In the play, he does not.
Okay.
They get rid of the apparitions. Mm-hmm. Of Elvira and Ruth.
And then, oh, yeah, by the way, Ruth dies. Ruth dies in the third act. Mm-hmm. If Ruth dies in the third act, she becomes a ghost.
Also, you know, that scientifically also doesn't make sense because how is she able to become an apparition like that? Right?
Oh,
she
dies,
enters the house and starts beating up Elvira. It's funny for a comedic reason, but technically, scientifically, how does that make sense?
I don't think scientifically is the correct word here.
Or what's spiritually?
Paranormally?
Paranormally? Metaphysically?
Metaphysically.
There we go.
Thank you, Eddie.
It doesn't make sense. And, you know, some people think that ghost hunting is a science, so we should at least respect those who make a living. So.
Okay.
So anyway, so that doesn't make sense, but whatever. They cease to become apparitions, right? But in terms of their spirits, they're still spirits. You might not be able to see or hear them, but they're still there. So she felt that they were still there, although, you know, now we can't see or hear them. So that's why she's get out of here. And in the play, he leaves, and then, like, you know, they tear up the set, and you see, like, things go flying and all this stuff to indicate that they are still there, but they're stuck there while he leaves. But in the film, for some reason, and I wonder why, because I really don't think it added anything to it. He dies. And
punished? Well, all right. He's supposed to be punished. Here's where I guess I'm kind of mixed in this portrayal of this movie.
Okay.
Where, yeah, I get that Charles is kind of cold. I get that Charles might be having a quasi-affair with a ghost. But technically speaking, it's a ghost. So why is Ruth feeling insecure about this? It's just
And he didn't divorce her. That was his wife, you know.
Yeah, you know, so, however, from a contractual marriage bound, technically speaking, he is not married to her, you know, he doesn't owe the ghost anything because it's till death do you part.
Mm-hmm.
After you become, when you become a ghost, it's just like, well, this ring is gone, sorry. but why, I guess, yeah, so the ending where Charles dies and he becomes a ghost with the two other ghosts, he's being punished, right, for something that I don't think the punishment doesn't fit the crime. He didn't commit any outrageous crime that merits him dying like that. You know what I mean?
Yes, I think, you know, in terms of having to actually like commit a crime in order to be condemned of something, you know, that's also a little.
No, you don't have to. I'm not saying it has to be a crime. I just mean like he needs to. He's being punished for, but like there's nothing. What's he being punished for being like an asshole to Ruth? But like, you know, by your read, Ruth is kind of being also, you know, a bitch to him. So
true. I mean, at the end of the day, these three people deserve each other. I think the one that didn't do anything wrong is Ruth. You know, she.
Right. I think Ruth is the victim of all of this.
She's more so the victim, and she gets the shit end of the stick and stuff like that. And him just also kind of like, I guess him not making more of an effort to keep his wife safe and actually to not engage in an affair with his dead wife's ghost might be the reason. But he was selfish and cold. So at the end of the day,
and he deserves to die for that. Like, how many times have I been selfish and cold? Like, if we're going by that, like,
I'm just saying that that's why they all deserve each other, and they should all just like be in, you know, this weird state of
purgatory together.
Yeah. Yeah. That's pretty much what it feels like.
Maybe.
But at the end of the day, I also, like I said, I didn't really care that he died, you know, so.
I mean, for it feels abrupt, and yet I think also it does work for comedic effect of, like, you know, when the two ghost ladies are there and then he pops up in between them.
Yeah. And it's like, oh, you thought you were escape us, but this is your fate. It's really, in a weird way, too, like, nihilistic and dark.
Yeah. What does that say about marriage, right? Like, it's just like, wow, I can't even escape you in death.
Exactly.
And that's the other thing I want to talk about, right? Like, because, yeah, he paints this picture of, actually, he, in this version, he doesn't really paint this picture of how much he loved Elvira.
Yeah, no, he doesn't.
It's not like in the new version where, like, he has, like, this, like, still, like, passion for her.
Yeah.
In this one, it's just like, she's dead. I'm moved on. Such is life. And when she comes back, like, yeah, he reminisces on all the good times they had. But, like, they didn't seem, like, that good, especially when they're in that car ride together and he's, you know, they're talking about, like, all the affairs that they've had on each other.
Yeah,
know,
how much they did enjoy the honeymoon and whatnot. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know.
That, yeah, so it's interesting because you don't even know that he has an ex-wife until the seance happens and he reacts to always. Right. Like, do you have to play always? And then it's simply is. She comes into the picture and then you start to know about her. So it's just more so.
You called her ex-wife. It's not an ex-wife.
First wife. Oh my gosh. Okay, yeah, sorry, police.
No, I only say that just because I think it's an important distinguisher. Because if she was an ex-wife who happened to die, now that's a more complicated story.
This is
but
true.
She is the first wife, right? She's not dead.
Yeah. I mean, so
now I do wish that, like, he was responsible for her death. Now we kind of start getting into this territory where you can still make that funny. It might be fucked up, but you can still make that funny, I think.
True.
So yeah, I'm picking apart the script a little here because I think, like, I guess maybe there was just not enough tension for me throughout this movie.
Ah, interesting. I wonder if it makes up for that in the new one, but we'll get to that in a second. No.
Okay.
You know, at the end of the day, this is a screwball comedy. Do you know what a screwball comedy is?
No, I've heard the term.
Screwball comedies are essentially a battle of the sexes. And it's usually where it's more so dominated by a strong female character who challenges the man character in a sense where it challenges his role as a man in society, right?
Okay.
So, yeah. So it's like they're fast paced. They're all about the dialogue. They're more so farce films. Like, everything feels like a farce. It involves courtship, marriage, disguises, masquerades, escapist themes sometimes. It's usually just, like, also, like, men versus women, right?
Wait, so, is His Girl Friday considered
a
screwball comedy?
Yes, that is a screwball comedy. Bringing Up Baby is a screwball comedy. Stuff like that. So,
okay.
So this is a screwball comedy, your technical one, but it adds this weird supernatural element, right? And like I said, like, Noel Coward doesn't really have time to describe the metaphysical aspects of it. It just simply is. Like, oh, now let's add this element, but it's still just a screwball comedy.
Right.
So that's why it's, like, it's interesting because this film is more so concerned with being a screwball comedy. And that's why I think it's I mean, I get why he, like, who fucking cares if he dies at the end? And, like, Noel Coward would have probably just preferred had he lived, because, like, it wasn't so much that they all kind of, like, should rot in purgatory together. That's what it kind of felt like. That's what I thought. You know, like I said, it felt kind of dark and nihilistic. But at the end of the day, too, it's just like it was just him escaping these women who were very much like he was stuck in between the two of them and he did not want to be anymore.
Right.
And then I guess Noel Coward wanted his quote-unquote hero to get the escape that he deserved, but I care. I don't know. At the end, I just feels like it should just end, like, as if nothing ever changed. That to me is the most satisfactory ending, where he's just, they're all going to be stuck like this forever. You're
so
going to
Noel
be in
Coward
operation forever.
Is,
and you're gonna
is, be so, so by what you're saying is that Noel Coward is okay with, he's not okay with divorce, but he's okay with your wife dying and then you getting off the hook.
Yes.
Wow. Cowardly indeed.
I mean, yeah, that's about all I have to say about the original. I think people should watch it just because it's also, like I said, it's as British as you can possibly get. And I'll say as English as you could possibly get. I mean,
is that a selling factor for American audiences?
Do people not enjoy English humor?
I don't know. I feel like a small population does, but not as big as, like, I feel like people pretend that they like British humor.
That's, well, I'm a big fan. I'm a bit, you know, of, I guess I won't call myself an Anglophile, but I do enjoy English mm-hmm. properties. I find English humor to be very funny. It's okay. just way drier. I think that the dialogue and everything about this film is what kind of works for me. And I think the performances are also what works for me. Although, yeah. you know, the characters aren't supposed to be likable. I think that's also the point.
Right.
They somehow, especially, you know, my beloved Madame Arcardi, they make you actually kind of like them and be on their side no matter how shitty they are. Not Madame Arcardi. She's not shitty. But the rest
yeah,
of them.
She's fine.
She's
I would agree with you. She's the only good guy in this movie.
Yes, she is. And she's the only one who's not like rich and stuff, you know, and that's also important because Madame Arcadi, you know, she's kind of like the town eccentric. Nobody really takes her seriously. She considers herself a medium, but she lives in a very humble bungalow. That's something that changes.
A humble bungalow. She lived in like, it was like basically a mansion.
A mansion?
Humble bungalow. It was like a big ass house.
I guess you think it was as big as the condominiums?
It was in a manor, but... It was still a big house.
Well, you know, I mean, finances have changed, right? So maybe she could have easily afforded it before.
I suppose. As far as I'm concerned, she should buy it. She's not 1%, but she's certainly like 15%.
Yeah. Well, she's also somebody who gets around on her bicycle all the time. You know, she's just direct contrast to the rest of them and stuff.
That's how you save money.
Yeah. And so she's got her wits about her a little bit more, even though she's doesn't really know what she's doing most of the time. But yeah, so that's something that changes a lot. You know, the plot is still going to be the same when we come to the 2021. They expand, yes. and then they change a couple of things, and they change some of the undertones in the new one, which, you know, does it make it better? Was it needed? Should we find out? Should we start talking about it?
Let's start talking about Blythe Spirit 2020/2021.
So the plot, like we said, you know, Charles Condamine, because of a seance that he holds, you know, unknowingly has the apparition of his deceased first wife come and join him. That's the same here, right?
That is your basic premise.
But we start, this film wants to provide backstory, I guess. Thinks that some of these characters need to be a little bit more fleshed out.
It's giving you, I will say this movie, what it does is it gives characters motivations for actions.
I guess.
Yeah, because like I said, the other one lacked tension. This one gives me motivation. That doesn't necessarily mean it's good. I'm just saying it does provide me with motivation for some of the actions.
Yeah. Well, this film also wanted it to be less of a play on film and make it a film. You know, we got that from like the first shot and just like the first segment, you know, like this filmmaker, it was directed by Edward Hall. You know, he was out to prove something. He really wanted this to be a film.
Do you know who he is?
Yeah, well, so I think this is his first feature film.
Oh.
Hopefully it's not his last. But he's known for directing a lot of English television. So he's done episodes of Downton Abbey. And
I've never seen, but I've heard good things.
He actually has done a bunch of Agatha Christie TV shows. He did he directed a couple episodes of the Marple TV show. He did Sleeping Murder there. He did the Partners in Crime, the Tommy and Tuppence adaptation of Agatha Christie. Agatha Christie is big in England. Another thing that I love is Agatha Christie, and she's very English and all this stuff. So I think I personally have a thing for some English properties, but this is his first film. Dan Stevens plays Charles Condamine, who I think is most famous from Downton Abbey.
He's from Downton Abbey?
Yeah, he's from Downton Abbey.
Oh, I only know him from Legion.
I know him. I think the only other thing I saw him in was that Will Ferrell movie that came out last year.
Will Ferrell was in movies last year?
Yeah, was about the Eurovision song.
Oh, I was thinking... Oh, Will Ferrell. I was thinking Colin Farrell.
Dan Stevens was in Beauty and the Beast.
Yes.
That's right. He was the Beast.
He was, yes. He was
He was covered in CGI for most of the movie, though. That's a cow.
Yeah, well. Yeah.
He was the Beast.
So, yeah. So, we got Dan Stevens as Charles Condamine in this one. We got Isla Fisher as Ruth Condamine. Leslie Mann as Elvira. And we have Judy Dench as Madame Arcadi.
Oh, speaking of Judy Dench, I asked Eddie this. And he said that he gave me an answer. Eddie, what was your answer? Oh, and I asked, what is Judy Dench famous for? Because I know that she's a dame, but what is she famous for? What was your answer, Eddie?
Oh, James Bond.
Okay, yeah, she was
and for a long time she had her own TV show. She had her own TV show. I want to say it's called Time and Again.
She was in a TV show called As Time Goes By.
As Time Goes By.
Which I actually really enjoy. It was on the BBC for a very long time. Or was that
Channel 1? And also she was, I want to say that she has played the queen. She played the queen in Shakespeare in Love.
She did. Yes, she did. So the thing about,
I feel like she's played the queen several times though.
I think she has too.
I was going to say, was she the queen? But I forgot her name already. Helen Mirren.
Helen Mirren. Oh yeah, Helen Mirren played the queen and the queen, yes.
Yes.
Well, so Judi Dench was very theater famous, and then she became like a international star when she played M in the James Bond films. And I think she was the best M. I'm a person who's seen all the James Bond films, and I love her as M. After that, you know, she just started getting, you know how like there's the Hollywood films that try to appeal to British audiences every year.
Yeah, yeah.
She's usually in those. So she's been in Shakespeare in Love. She was in remember that movie Philomena, about like the Irish nun, I think she was.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Iris, Chocolat, Notes on a Scandal, you know, so she's just like typically cast. So you always see Judi Dench, but who knows if you actually watch her movies.
Well, yeah, that's what I was going to say, because I was just like, as I was watching the movie, I'm just like, why Judi Dench?
Dame Judi Dench.
What a tongue twister. All right. But I was just like, but what is she famous for? Because that's it. That was just my question. I was just like,
yeah,
all right,
she's definitely one of those people that everybody knows. But like you said, you know, it's like, think about it. Where do I really know her from?
What's I remember her in the Chronicles of Riddick.
Yeah, she's sadly in random shit, man. And she was in Cats.
Yeah.
She was in Cats.
That's right. She was in Cats.
So was everybody.
Yeah. So was everybody.
Almost everybody.
We forgive her. But yeah, so Judi Dench is in this. And honestly, Judi Dench, I think, is a great actress. And she barely is given a role for her to show her versatility. And this film is like no exception to that. Almost stereotyping of Judi Dench, where she usually just plays like the old woman. That's it. She just plays the old woman. I mean, right off the bat, I'm just going to say I hated Madame Arcadi in this film.
Oh, I preferred this Madame Arcadi.
How dare you? I mean, well, so I hated the side story they gave her about her trying to get in touch with her love, long lost love.
Right.
I know you said that's motivation, but that was just stupid.
I agree. It created motivation as to like, why does her character do the things that she does, right?
I don't think I needed it. I mean,
well, I would agree with her character. This is one character that you don't need a backstory for.
You don't need a backstory. They completely changed her dynamic. She went from the town eccentric who claims to be a successful medium to a star who's selling out theaters. But then none of that matters because almost instantly she loses her fame, right?
She instantly loses her fame, but she does have this beautiful house by the Cliffs of Dover.
Mm-hmm.
I remember seeing it. It's just like, wow, what a view. Like, that house must be a fucking fortune.
Yeah. So it's just like, why does she have to be in that stature? And just for her to lose it when none of that even comes into play or is a motivation for her to help these characters or comes into play with the actual stories.
Town, though, because I don't think she lives in that town.
What?
I don't think she doesn't live in, like, because they're out. They were in what? London?
She
was in Sussex, but that's not where they were.
I don't remember. Look at that. Okay. I just watched this movie 3 hours ago, and I don't remember.
No, the reason I say that is just because, like, but she had international fame. She wasn't just famous in England.
So she was. So it didn't matter.
She's doing like nightly shows. I think she was just like maybe on tour or something.
Well, she said they expect you to come up with the miracle show after show, day after day.
Mm, yeah.
So I feel like she would have been doing
I feel like she would have been selling snake oil to all sorts of different countries. So like her source of income isn't ruined.
I disagree.
She's a huckster.
I mean, a lot of her money came from her success on the theater, and then like she went to go visit that.
But also, word of mouth too,
and word of mouth.
Yeah,
I mean, the internet didn't exist back then, guys. So like, just like,
but printing press still existed. People were still able to pick up a newspaper and listen to the radio.
He just, like, comes up with a new name. All right, we're getting lost in the weeds.
We really are. But they even like tore up her card. You know, like it was pretty ubiquitous at that point that she was a fraud.
Anywho. Wait, you're talking about, okay, that's another side story that she had, her involvement with Houdini and the people who, and the spiritualists.
Yeah.
That, I don't know what that was about, why we needed that. I thought
he wasn't Harry.
It wasn't Harry.
He was saying he was friends with Harry.
But I think he is one of the, you know how Harry Houdini was like on this quest to like stop spiritualists because he thought they were like just ripping people off. Mm-hmm. All right. So I'm pretty sure he was one of the, I think he was another real figure that was like kind of involved with that kind of group.
Yeah. Side note, Rolando, were you in grad school still when we attended MoMA? We saw that whole like 5D show about early spiritualism and Harry Houdini and Arthur Conan Doyle. Were you there or had you graduated at that point?
I don't remember that one. No.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah. Never mind.
I worked at Houdini's. I actually did a shoot in Houdini's studio.
Ah.
It's actually in Union City.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh.
Really?
Yeah, Houdini Studio is in Union City.
Wow, look at that. Fun facts. They should turn that into a tourist trap.
Well, it's a studio, so coincidentally called the Houdini.
Look at that. Yeah.
But yeah, I have no idea what that storyline plot was about.
Yeah. It was just a shame. I really don't think that they needed to add all of that to Madame McCarty. Perhaps they wanted to hit that she was a fraud, like, harder, and then, like, have this whole reveal that actually she was able to successfully bring an apparition, to this world. But it didn't land for me.
I mean, this movie is, like, an extra 20 minutes?
No, I think they're about the same length. I mean, the original was about an hour and a half. This one was about an hour and a half plus 9 minutes.
Okay, so, all right. Well, those 9 minutes feel like an eternity, though.
They really do. I mean, this whole film felt quite long.
I will say this. I kept pausing the movie to make conversation with Eddie. As, you know, you secretly look at how much is left, and it's just like, oh, there's so much of this movie left right now. Why?
Yeah, I kept doing that, too. I was like, how much more? How much more?
Cool, yeah, that's my favorite thing to do. Like, I love to pause movies to talk about it with Eddie. But sometimes if the movie's good, you're like anxious, right?
Yeah,
you're
don't like, oh my God, pause
there's only
it, yeah.
so much. There's only so much left. But like here, I'm just like looking for any excuse to pause it. And
I paused this movie a bunch of times. Mm-hmm. Excuse me, now I have hiccups, but they add a couple. They're like punching me in the chest or something.
Like, stop talking shit about our movie.
They add a lot more to the dynamics of the relationships that Charles has with either Alvira or Ruth, right? So immediately in the beginning, when he has his writer's block, you know, we see that his relationship with Ruth is a little strained. They're not physical with each other.
He keeps making erectile dysfunction.
Yeah, he keeps making references.
And this is a time before Viagra.
Mm-hmm. Mr. P's body comes into play a lot.
That's the name of his penis.
Yeah, that's what he calls his penis. And also, he is still somewhat hung up on Elvira. He often looks at her picture while he's writing, to the point where when Ruth comes in, she finds that, you know, the picture of the two of them lands on the floor and she sees it and makes her feel, you know, like awkward. So like there is the tension between his deceased first wife and her, you know, her living in her shadow.
Which I appreciate, right? Because it gives you a little bit more idea of what they were together. And then they also add the fact that, like, she was his muse.
Yes.
Which I think is an important... There's a payoff for that at the end. And again, I think fleshing out these relationships, not the worst idea. Could it have been done more to greater effect? Yes.
100%.
However, I will say, in terms of comparing it from the original one to this one, I think that was a smart move. Again, not necessarily successfully.
You know, executed. I'll say something about the first 10 minutes of this film. I actually had a lot of high hopes for it. You know, I thought, oh, wow, it's being cinematic. You know, it's not going to be a play on film. You know, the art direction, the costumes, I was like, oh, this is a really accurate period piece. Mm-hmm. Not so much for the script. I mean, you know, when you have Noel Coward's Woody, you know, rapport going on, and you add a good amount of dialogue that he didn't write, it's just very noticeable. And the dialogue was too busy, you know, setting up exposition or explaining stuff and setting up things for later, that it was very distracting.
Yes.
For me, at least. I know that you watched this one first, so perhaps you might not have noticed
I didn't notice. I noticed it. You noticed it. And when I'm watching the second one, I was watching the original one, right?
Cause yeah.
I saw all there was a lot of times where like the dialogue was basically the same.
Yes. You know? Yeah. A couple times there were. Not a few. Much. But
a chunk.
Well, so, But other than that, I thought that it was going to be hopeful, except for Dan Stevens's portrayal of Charles. I think that the biggest problem I had with this film would be Dan Stevens' portrayal of Charles Condamine.
Let's get into it. Why, Nicole? Why do you hate Dan Stevens, our beast, our legion?
He was almost, he was so theatrical to the point of being cartoonish. Uh-huh. He overacted, I thought. I thought that he also didn't give me enough to sympathize with Charles Condamine. Now, you know, Rex Harrison, we said he was kind of cold, right? And he was kind of wooden most of the time. But he was believable in his role. Dan Stevens is kind of the opposite, but he lacks any real, to me at least, warmth or depth to his character. And he's incredibly unbelievable in his role. I just felt like the whole time I was watching an actor.
I mean, I don't disagree with you about watching an actor, but I also will blame the script on that.
Okay.
And I don't know. I think in terms of like when I'm watching a comedy, right, I think that that's one of the things. I'm not all comedies need to have that kind of overacting, mm-hmm. but I feel like sometimes that just happens a lot naturally in comedies, right? Like usually you're in situations that are just not real. And so as a result, like you're kind of just you're kind of turning that knob on your performance to kind of like accentuate that a little. And I think he did that.
I think he did it. Did he do it successfully? No, he almost felt like Jim Carrey in Ace Ventura, you know?
There you go. I don't disagree with you. I got very much Jim Carrey vibes from yeah. this performance. Yes, agreed.
I thought, you know, it was all the way to 11 and it didn't need to be that way all the fucking time. I mean, from the moment the movie started, he was turned to 11.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
it was it was just a bit much.
From him just like being this like, I'm a terrible writer. I can't write. How am I going to write my screenplay? And then you have Isla Fisher, who again is also. So I think my critiques actually come from the females. Most of the females in this cast, I think Leslie Mann might have been the wrong choice for this role.
Ah, interesting.
And same thing with Isla Fisher, because I hate to say this, but Isla Fisher is not a particularly good actress. She's
yeah, I mean, you know, most of the time, I mean, I hate to be this person too, but I'm like, why couldn't you have cast a British person? Because like, I'm also aware of the fact that you're not British.
Well, she's American, you know? Right? Wasn't she American?
Is she American? Are you asking me if Isla Fisher is American?
No, I meant the character.
Oh, of Ruth? No, absolutely
Ruth wasn't
not.
American?
They're all British.
Not Leslie Mann. She was American.
In the original, they're all British. I'm sorry, I misunderstood your question. Yeah,
yeah. In the remake, I'm pretty sure. I know that Elvira was American.
Yes, Elvira was straight up American, but no,
but
Ruth
I don't know.
Was
Ruth wasn't?
You know,
I think Ruth was.
Then what was she supposed to have? A transcontinental accent? Because she came off as trying to do a British accent.
Oh wait, that's right. Because she was. The daughter of a British filmmaker, of the British producer.
Yeah.
So I guess she was supposed to be British.
I think she was supposed to be British.
Did she have an accent? I didn't even notice her accent.
She did. I noticed it.
I don't know. I guess maybe I just like kind of tune out Isla Fisher a little bit.
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, like you have
this. She's like a yappy little dog. She's all like.
They give them this whole dynamic where it's like, you know, there's like, you know, trouble in paradise and they're not. You know, she lives in the shadow and yet nothing really stands out about her performance. You know, like they give her all of this and nothing really happens with it.
Mm-hmm.
The one that stands out way more, because also just the way that they went about with is Elvira, because she's just so abrasive of a character in this one.
But she starts off way too abrasive right from the get-go.
From the get-go, right? So Leslie Mann plays Elvira in this one. She's American in this one. You know, right. Strong Zelda Fitzgerald vibes from the start.
I just want to point out, they don't say that she's American until, like, much later into her appearance.
Yes, even though it's pretty apparent.
It was apparent, but I was very confused. It's just like, wait, why is it... Where's her accent? And I kept thinking, just like, did Leslie Mann just not want to do an accent? Yeah. And it wasn't until like later on when he confirms, like, my little American star. And
yeah.
I was like, oh, okay, so she's American.
Yeah.
I would bring that up earlier, but all right.
I guess, yeah. I mean, that didn't bother me so much. You know, it was interesting because in the original, you know, Elvira, she appears and she's just observing everyone, but she knows she's dead.
Right.
An element that they added in this is that Elvira didn't know she was dead. You know, for her, it was just a couple of seconds and she didn't know what happened.
She just comes to her house and she sees it remodeled and there's another woman.
And yeah. And she's just like, I can't believe you did this. So like she comes to terms with the fact that she's dead. She does. No. And then like within the same scene and then everything yeah. continues. And we actually find out that Elvira was not only his muse, but was he pretty much, you know, ghost wrote her books.
Right.
She was the real creative one of the between the two. Yeah. And he took credit for it.
A big plot point.
A big plot point. You know, so they actually make Charles a little bit more despicable, I suppose, in this one because he used her for his own means.
I mean, I feel like that's par for the course back then, right? Men using women.
I suppose, yeah. You know, there was that whole film Big Eyes about this successful painter who back in the day, the husband took all the credit for her and stuff. So, you know, and we don't know half the people out there that had that too. You know, there are a lot of people who think that Shakespeare was a woman. And there's a lot of evidence to support that claim. There's a lot.
I thought that Shakespeare was gay.
Well, so, okay.
Bisexual.
Okay, good. Perhaps. So bisexual representation.
Here's what I sidetrack really quick, just so I could let you know what I believe about William Shakespeare is that I believe that there was a William Shakespeare, but I believe that he was paid by someone to pretend to be William Shakespeare. The reason is because, one, there's not any real writing of him, and William Shakespeare as an individual, what they have of him, it is clear that he was illiterate. His parents were illiterate and his children were illiterate. How can the greatest playwright of all time be not only come from illiterate parents, raise illiterate children, and the only time we ever see his little like physical markings of his name is when he was a dock worker?
My guess is that he had a scribe and then he would just dictate everything to the scribe and the scribe would just write it and then do lots of editing.
No, I don't think so.
No, you don't buy that?
I mean, it makes a lot of sense in theory, but there's also just all these other factors that I'm not going to get into.
I mean,
I can't say I
wake at night thinking it's just like, who is a real William Shakespeare? Because he's been dead for 600 years. It's just like, I don't care.
I think it would be really damn cool if it was either a woman or a bunch of other people for us to
finally know
the truth.
I mean, I
want to
believe that Jesus Christ was also a woman, but like it's irrelevant information. This late in the game. So we're talking about fake things, ghosts here, so let's get back to it.
So Elvira is really the creative writing genius, and you know, whatever it is, it makes Charles a little bit less likable as a character. So I already didn't like him because mainly of Jeremy Stevens' portrayal of him, and he just they really
you
also
don't find
make
that out
very...
also until later though.
Oh, that she was the ghostwriter?
Yeah, that she's a ghostwriter.
No, almost immediately when they're, you know, in their dialogue, she was like, oh, they're adapting your film and you haven't written a word of it and you haven't written any since I died. What are the odds of that?
Well, they hinted at that, but I guess, again, I also took that as just like, well, she's a muse.
I immediately got that she was the writer.
Interesting. No, I didn't get that until like literally like when they talk about it at the Hitchcock set. By the way, Hitchcock was present for like a brief second in this movie.
Yeah.
Everyone.
Well, they also mentioned Greta Garbo like 17 times in this movie.
Yeah.
It's like Greta Garbo was the only star. Anyway. Yeah. So they added that, but I think they ruined Elvira in this one and I don't think it's Leslie Mann's fault. I think that out of all of them, she was actually kind of the most believable in terms of her acting and as a character. But God, is Elvira just so terrible in this and annoying.
I mean, in this one, Elvira is kind of very mean to the point where it's just like unlikable.
Yeah.
It's not even like mean girl. It's just straight up just evil.
You're not like, oh yeah, girl, get what's yours. You know, fuck
him
and all this stuff.
Despite the fact that that's how the movie is setting you up at the end to feel that way.
Mm-hmm.
And when the end happens, you're just like, no. I don't approve.
Yeah, the movie wants you to feel like these women were almost in a way victimized by him and him being like a, you know, like a skeevy, despicable prick.
This movie has there's like a sense of like girl power at the end of this film. So, all right. So spoiler alert, guys, if you guys want to like know what happens at the end here, stop here. But I'm going to tell you guys right off the bat. The ending of this movie is that Ruth dies and he is able to get the Madame Alucard to get rid of the ghosts, the spirits, right?
Yeah.
If I remember correctly. Yeah. So she gets rid of the spirits. And he then goes off to Hollywood. He's written the screenplay. And when he is like in the middle of directing his film, well, he's not directing, but like he's on set directing the film, he with the director, and a reporter from the LA Times comes. She wants to interview him, and she reveals that like all the work that he has published is all plagiarized from a Mexican
mystery writer,
right? And it turns out that Elvira, she knew this all along, and she was just kind of just like setting him up for failure from the get-go, which is a long con, but
a very long con.
But you know, after, so his career is ruined as a result, and he leaves, and then somehow, some way, the ghosts are still able to drive cars, and Ruth hits him with his car, killing him
on a crowded now, Hollywood studio lot, nonetheless.
Yes, and yeah, that's right.
No one reacted.
The car drives away.
Even though at some point in the film, you know, people thought he was going insane to the point he was put into a sanitarium. Nobody saw him get by no one driving a car. Yeah,
I will say this. The ending for this movie was so rushed. Even like the editing from like when Madame Alucard's like deceased lover comes, all of a sudden like they're like outside in the field together. I'm just like, where?
That was very confusing editing, right? So she's you know, trying to figure out, you know, how to get rid of Elvira. She unknowingly conjures back up Ruth. That whole thing goes and everybody leaves and she's still trying at it, and all of a sudden the apparition of her dead lover comes. Then the next cut we see is her desk with his picture and her books, and then the next cut after that is them walking on the beach. It didn't make sense in terms of editing.
I was confused. I thought it was a flashback, and I'm just like, oh, this isn't her lover. This is her son. But then I was just like, no, wait, but she said this was her lover. She said this was her husband. So like, this makes no sense.
But also is like, are you doing that for me as an audience? Do you think I'm that daft that I don't know who this is, that you have to cut back to the picture on her desk for me to know that that's who she's now walking literally off in the sunset with?
There was no subtlety in like who this guy was. Like,
absolutely none.
We knew what her motivation was. Again,
there wasn't enough for us to want her to find him, you know? It was literally, it was planted. And then I was like, oh, okay, well, this must be her motivation. And then that was it. And then at the end, it got delivered. Literally just a plant and deliver. It was so not needed. And if you were going to do that, add more depth to it, which it didn't. And what a fucking waste of Judi Dench and Madame Arcari. Now, I know you said you liked her better. Wonderful would it have been if this Madame Arcari was just like how she was portrayed in the original, as portrayed now by Judi Dench. How fun would it have been to see Judi Dench portray this role in that way? You know, riding her bike, kooky, and you know, people not taking her seriously. Like,
that would be a cute scene, right? Seeing Judi Dench riding a bike. Can she ride a bike?
I mean, the woman's, like, I think she's like 90 years old, so probably not. Like, maybe you might have to CGI double
that a little.
Yeah. But
that's
the same
CGI
time,
is for, guys.
But she could have done that role. I mean, Angela Lansbury did it at her age, very not so long ago, on the stage 8 fucking times a week, man. Why couldn't Judi Dench do this in this movie? And I'm not saying that Judi Dench was the reason that they didn't, but like, what an opportunity wasted. This is a role that people die to play on the stage when they become older. Lansbury's done it. Jennifer Saunders have done it. So many women have done it because this is something that you get to have fun with, and they completely robbed her of that. And she just gets to be her usual, like, proper Judi Dench. But now she's a medium, and it's just like, what a waste.
Right.
Sorry, I had to rant
about
that.
Mind you, this is a British movie too, though.
Yeah, no, this is a British film. This isn't like
this isn't like a Hollywood movie.
Yeah, they helped distribute it, but that's it. And in terms of distribution, I think only IFC was the one who picked it up to distribute it, so... Studio Canal,
independent film channel worthy. This is not. I'll tell you that.
Unfortunately,
much.
I just, just a couple.
We really jumped a lot all over the place, but I think we can wrap this up because just from the sounds of it, I could just tell we were just not happy with it. Eddie, I just want to hear your take on this real quick because I know you were not a fan of this movie. Why would you say, if you were sum it up, why were you not a fan of this movie?
It sucked.
Okay, I thought you had something a little more profound to say. Anything you
want
to expand?
No, bravo. No. So, I just felt it was such a waste of basically actors that I really enjoy in other things. Actors that I really enjoy in other things. I was very surprised that it just didn't. I was just confused just confused. I mean, I understood what the plot was, but I just felt the execution was done badly. There were moments I was wondering, is this a comedy? Is this the story of a man and living in a domestic violence situation?
Wait, what's the violence?
What was the violence?
Oh, the ghost.
Yes, and her throwing things and planning his death. And then the tragic death of his wife, his living wife. And there's that. And it was just kind of all confusing. And it's like, is the madam character, was she like powerful but didn't know it? That she kept on just summoning, like, she said, like, this is like a, what it was, like, third level
operation. Level 10.
Level 10 operation.
This is level 10.
That she had like a gift of just summoning, but she couldn't get rid of them. So, I don't know. I did not enjoy it at all. It was moments I was wondering maybe this was just edited horribly.
Oh no. Yeah, agreed.
And yeah, it wasn't edited very well. You know, I remember last year when we saw Dr. Doolittle, another Rex Harrison venture of sorts, and I didn't think that I would be able to see anything that was so aggressively unfunny as that, and yet Blight Spirit really did it, because it was unbelievable just how not funny it was. And it was going so hard for laughs.
This one? And,
yeah.
It was just so weird.
I don't know. You guys are really being hard because I think, you know, for a comedy, you gave me some of the things I wanted.
Like the weird thing when she gets all high on the medication that...
wasn't funny.
Drink. Mm-hmm. And then she's like... So she's dancing her underwear in the fish pond, right? Then he takes her upstairs... Right. And so the party's still probably going on. But he's upstairs with her. She takes a nap. And I think that's the part where he has sex with the ghost wife.
Yes. He has sex with ghost wife.
Yeah.
You know,
and terrible.
And then the next scene is, so it's the middle of the day, right? Probably lunch. It looks like a brunch situation. And then the next scene is morning. And she's saying, oh, you were squirming a lot last night. And I'm like, did they sleep that whole entire time?
Well, she was drugged out of her mind.
No, I'm talking about him.
Oh, did he? No, I think he was banging his wife the whole entire time.
Well, it was just crazy.
Yeah.
You know?
Do you remember when in the new one, she accidentally kills Ruth and then all of a sudden it cuts to her and she's like, oops. I mean, I was supposed that, like, I literally felt like, insert laugh here. Nothing. You know, even like when Ruth died and he's attending the funeral and Elvira's there.
But I actually laughed at the car scene. This is a car flying off the cliff. How do you not laugh at that? That's great physical comedy.
What?
I thought it was
physical of the car?
Yeah, the car just flying off of a cliff.
That's a physical comedy?
That is the a car? Physical... I laughed. I mean, I laughed. But I did want to say this though before I forget. How long can you go without using the brake is my question.
Oh, like the pause? Oh, the break, yeah. It's bad.
And even the stupid scene of like throwing knives at the cook to get her to run off too. Like, what's the motivation about that? Like, why?
And why did they take so many knives for the cook to leave?
Yeah. And then
that
the
was done better in the original.
You know, and then the housekeeper stood almost to the very end until she was like, this house is crazy. I'm out of here. You know, so,
right. But you remember how that was done in the original, was that he just comes back and like they're all like with their bags and their packages, and then you can see them limping and they're going off. It's like, oh my god, what happened when I was away? You know, like the suggestion of what happened instead of actually seeing it worked better in the original than in the new one. You know, it's just they were trying to expand upon it and they didn't make it better at all.
You got
to
work with the source material. I actually think watching this, if you remake this down the line, I wonder what it would be like if you have homosexuals.
Okay.
Right? Like, like make Charles a homosexual. Even better, right? I got it. You make Charles his first wife being an actual wife, and now he's married to a twink. Right? There you go. Now there's your setup. Now you want to add some real drama there. You have the twink constantly being just like, I can't compete with a real ghost vagina. There you go. I got you. I gave Hollywood a new story right here, right now.
This is one of a few, I'll call these gold star episodes, and where at the end, Rolando just says, next time you remake it, make it gay. Because sometimes they do make it better, you know? Honestly, it would be better. Like, remember when we did An Affair to Remember? It's like, imagine if this was gay. It probably would have been more interesting.
Mm-hmm. So there you go. Yeah. That's my pitch to Hollywood on that one.
I think we know the answer to this question, but do you think that Blythe Spirit was needed to be remade?
Oh, no.
Eddie, no.
This is for anybody.
I'm going to say, I mean, no, but only because, like, no. No, just no. You know why? Because the first one is just, like, it's fine. I don't know if, why would you remake something that's just, like, okay? That's my
okay.
That's
well,
my stance.
I mean, I think it's a little bit better than just okay. But let me. This is why I think that this wasn't remade. Other than the fact that it just, you know, the world doesn't need another forgettable film. If you're gonna add something new to it, or if you're gonna say something new, and you want to add a twist, like a feminist twist or something, I guess, you know, just like make sure you're actually doing that, and that the people who are in charge of that know what they're doing and know how to freaking write a script. And at the end of, you know, Blythe Spirit has been revived many times on the stage, right? And it's still a success. So this was kind of inevitable. But if the play itself, as it is such a success every time you do it, I'm just confused as to why they thought that they should defer so heavily. I mean, I think that only about 45 of Noel Coward dialogue was actually in this film. And so much of it was changed. Yeah.
I agree.
I think less than half. And yeah. And the only things that might have worked for me at all in the film were the moments that were taken straight out of the play. So why would you do that? If you knew you had a surefire thing with this, then why would you change so drastically from your source material? Like, you didn't really offer us anything new. So no, it wasn't needed. And if you're going to give me, if you're going to pander to me in terms of a feminist level, right? At least know what you're fucking doing.
Do you think that they were? I know I said that there was like a girl power read to it at that end, but do you really think
that's
it was
what
there?
They were going for? That's what they were trying to do, but they, it was uneven. It was bad writing and it was bad uneven filmmaking. That like I saw, I was like, oh, I was supposed to be rooting for these girls, and they were supposed to have a bond, and they were supposed to be being like, fuck you to the guy, and I didn't feel any of that.
You know, for some particular reason, and they're totally two different genres films, but the movie Death Becomes Her.
Ah, I love that movie.
Do you remember that one?
Yeah, I love that movie.
Goldie Hawn and Meryl Streep, right?
Yeah.
Right. And Bruce Willis.
Yeah.
Right? See, like that one, where the tension of the new wife, the old wife, that element of the supernatural, they're undead.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's like they have this like rivalry with each other. You know, and then it's like he becomes like the focus, and at the end, their actions destroy themselves, but there's a redeeming aspect for the male lead, in this particular movie. But this didn't give me any. I mean, it's not the same movie, but it's not the same movie. But it didn't give me any of that. There was no redemption. In any of this.
Yeah, yeah. There was no one was redeemed.
Yeah.
And it's redeemable.
You know, there's a lot of flaws to Death Becomes Her, but overall it hits what it's supposed to, and you actually get the story. You actually get that this guy actually is stuck between these two women who just are such in a feud with each other, and you know, who are just trying to constantly one up each other, that they're just gonna be doing that for the rest of their lives. You know, like that story actually has a full circle to it. And you get it, you feel it, and you don't feel any of the moments, or there's no full circle in this movie. You know, there's no like hitting the plot points here, and like the beats that you're supposed to feel as an audience. It's just so uneven and such a shame, because I was hoping that this would encourage people to go back and watch the original film. First of all, nobody knows that this movie is out. I'm surprised if we're going to get any listens. But second of all, people are not going to want to go and watch the original, because they're going to think they're going to think that it's as bad, and it's not. It's, I know that you didn't care for it, but it is truly the better film, and better. It's the one worth watching. And if you're going to watch between one of these two films.
No. Yeah. I mean, yeah, I'll admit to that. Like, I think the original one was the better film.
Yeah, it was. Thank you. Sure. Thank you for agreeing with me.
Of course. Here's where we're going to disagree in the lightning round. Pew,
lightning round.
Yeah, because literally, Charles, Ruth, Madame Akkadi, and Elvira are all the original for me.
Oh, okay. Well, Charles, I'm actually going to go with Dan Stevens. He just felt a little more lively. I'm sorry, Nicole. I'm going to go with Dan Stevens on that one.
How could you?
And Madame Arcadi, I will go also
How could
with
you?
Judi what? Dench.
Because there was nothing to her character. So her character had no depth. There was no personality. Feel
like I didn't care for the other one. I was just like, ugh.
But she was now, a more well-rounded character. She
I feel the only person who could have played this character better would be, oh, well, get rid of Judi Dench. I would have played, Cloris Leachman should have played this role. All right?
Granted, yes, she probably would have added a little bit more to it. And that's not to say that Judi Dench is a bad actress. So good. But I almost feel like they didn't know Judi Dench's comfortability and they made it more subdued. You said the first Madame Arcadia was subdued. The second one was way more subdued.
No, because she was a straight up huckster. Plus, she went on her own little adventure trying to go to like the spiritualists and stuff. Yeah, I'm gonna give Judi Dench his
own. Oh my god, Judi Dench deserves a win. Two different films, man. I don't know if you made it all the way to the end and you've seen both films and you have an opinion about Madame Arcadi, please share with us. Because I don't know if I can put this one to rest with Rolando. Bother me for a while.
Come, let us know, guys. And people, you can let us know on facebook.com/remakes/reboots/revivals. We're also on Instagram at Remakes Reboots Revivals. You can email us. Our email address is remakesrebootsrevivals@gmail.com. I almost forgot the important parts. We also have a hotline, guys. So reach out to us. Nicole, what is that number?
You can call us 862-248-2326. Please call us. Leave us a voicemail. Let your voice literally be heard. 862-248-2326.
Yes. And also be sure to give us a review and rating on Apple iTunes. It will help people find us and it'll just help us know what people like about our show.
All right. Well, I guess, you know, it's time for us to cross over into the other dimension. It's time for us to be sent back.
I can't wait.
I'll be loving you always. It's the song.
From both movies. Okay. Yeah. Right.
I figured I'd serenade you. All right, I'm going to go find Daphne and get out of here. So until next time,
stay original.